The lights are on red. We're away.
Welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, November 2nd, 2007, and this is episode number 102. I guess you could say that we're well into the 100s on our episode counts. Kind of cool. But in any case, we're here for a while, at least much longer, and 100 episodes. Hopefully, we'll do 100 more. So, got kind of an interesting show today, a little bit different than usual. We have Thomas Reynolds, Australian freelance moto journalist, contacted me a couple of weeks ago, and we were doing a call with him talking about his experiences at Phillip Island, which I know we're kind of jumping back a few weeks there to go back to Phillip Island, but it's some really good stuff. Thomas had some fantastic insight and all of that, and he also provided us some interviews with Casey Stoner and Ant West. It's really interesting stuff. I think you're going to enjoy that, so we're going to get to that. Of course, before we get to that, we do have a few notes and some news and a little bit of a Valencia preview and all kinds of good stuff like you've come to expect on the MotoGPOD podcast. So before we get into any of all of that, let me say a big thank you this week to Mickey Hamilton and Andrew Ganderton for their donations to the cause of MotoGPOD. They were kind enough to go to MotoGPOD.com and click on the link there on the left-hand side and make a donation. Helps pay for the bandwidth, helps pay for the equipment that I buy, the Skype call credit, all that sort of stuff, the costs that I do incur making the podcast. But let's see. After that, we've got some news. Red Bull U.S. Grand Prix tickets go on sale this week at Laguna-Seca.com. So if you're going to the Red Bull U.S. Grand Prix in California at Laguna Seca in July, which is, of course, the official U.S. Grand Prix, then you want to make sure you get your tickets and go ahead and get those. I believe it's November 5th that you can buy tickets unless you're already one of the camping super special campground holders that manages to get your tickets a couple days early. Good stuff there. Make sure you go and get them. And tickets for the Indianapolis Grand Prix, the Red Bull Indianapolis Grand Prix in, funnily enough, Indianapolis, have been on sale for a while, and apparently hotel rooms are booking up fast. So I have no idea what camping is like at Indianapolis. Perhaps somebody that's got some experience going to a race at Indy can let us know. So you might be doing the hotel thing, and you might want to make sure that you start getting a motel or a hotel there. And of course, the same is going to be true at Laguna Seca. If you want to stay in a hotel and you don't like the idea of roughing it, you're going to want to get that hotel reserved quickly. So they got two U.S. Grand Prix next year. It's good stuff. And you want to make sure you get your tickets so that you can get the right package and make the best of the weekend and be comfortable and happy and party and do all the kinds of things that we like to do at Grand Prix, as well as have, of course, a fantastic time watching the race and get the good tickets and all of that good stuff. Moving on, why don't we talk a little bit about some of the emails that I received over the last week. First thing, and I want to mention this while it's fresh in my mind after talking about the Laguna Seca Grand Prix and the Indianapolis Grand Prix, Steve Jones at usmotogpfans.com has his suites going on again next year. He's got suites set up for Laguna Seca, Indianapolis, working on Barber for the Superbike round, and he's going to host a fantastic sweet deal that he's done for the past couple of years. Basically, you get a seat in the suite. You've got a fantastic view of the front straight there, start finish line, that sort of thing. There's TVs in there, there's free food, there's booze, there's all kinds of good stuff. And most importantly, for Laguna Seca and Indianapolis, when you're talking about that kind of time of year, there's air conditioning. So you might want to consider doing that. Check it out. Steve Jones's website is at usmotogpfans.com. And of course, I'll put a link to that up on the MotoGPOD website. And Steve Jones would very much appreciate it if you went up there and booked a ticket with him in his sweet deals. And if you do, and you happen to tell Steve that Bob from MotoGPOD sent you, then that's all good and the stuff. And Steve likes it. I like it. Everybody's happy. And who knows, maybe I'll see you there. I generally get a chance to talk to Steve whenever I do, and he's always a nice guy to talk to. Lots of fun. I do enjoy that. We got some email about our ship to shore conversation that we had. Actually, it wasn't so much a conversation as a story that David Emmett from the Kropotkin Thinks blog at MotoGPMatters.com. David was kind enough to send that in. If you haven't heard last week's show, make sure you download it. It's a very good opinion piece talking about radio communications between rider and pits. And much like you see in Formula One all the time, and why don't they have it in MotoGP? And actually, I'll tell you, David converted me. His points were excellent, and I agree. I'm a fan now. I'm a convert. It should not happen in MotoGP for a variety of reasons, but we did get an email here, and I didn't get a name. I've got Clavius. So if it's your real name, Clavius. And in any case, it's sent in an email. So I just started listening to last week's podcast. Great as always. Your topic about ship-to-shore communication is one of my favorite pet peeves. I agree wholeheartedly with David Emmett's opinion. And he'd also like to add a few things that the jet fighter pilot reference is moot, being that most of the combat instrumentation is for beyond visual range combat, and that when a fighter pilot is in a dogfight, he's looking out that canopy and he's got a heads-up display. And Clavius moves on to say that this is much like what a MotoGP racer is going to be doing most of the time. He's not going to be looking down at that dash. He's going to be concentrating out and looking through his turns and all that sort of things. And he compares, and let me find it here real quick in the email, because it's a rather long email. He sort of gives the analogy that MotoGP racers are fighter pilots in a dogfight, and that Formula One and he says NASCAR, but okay, we'll go with that. Formula One and NASCAR, basically, you know, car racing drivers are more like bomber pilots on a bomber run. So while you may take that as you will, I think he's got a lot to it, because one thing that I neglected to mention and that Clavius reminded me of is that a motorcycle racer has a lot more to worry about with body positioning. If you noticed, whenever you get the ass cam going on in MotoGP when you're watching that race, you see that guy moving around on that motorcycle a lot. His side to side, huge shifts in weight ratio and transfer from side to side on the bike, and forward and back that you don't quite see as much on the ass cam, but it does happen when they're coming into a turn, a variety of different things, going uphill, going downhill, whatever it is, they will shift around on that seat a lot. They're constantly in motion, and this is one of the reasons why they have to be so fit. And this is one thing that you do not get so much of in a car. Typically a Formula One racer, which is one of the comparisons that we're making because ship to shore, the Formula One racer is sitting in a seat and he's tightly strapped in, very, very tightly strapped in to the point of being painful, into a very, very small seat. Now he's got a lot of other stuff to worry about, and I'm not denigrating the skill and talent and physical stamina and strength that are required for a car racer, even things series that I don't particularly enjoy, say NASCAR. It is different. You know, they're not doing the same things. They're not using the same skill set. They're not using the same motor skills and coordination and whatnot. And I still stand behind my somewhat slurry and disjointed opinion that I made last week that riding a motorcycle at the level of MotoGP racer is harder than driving a car at the level of Formula One racer. Harder for most people. Everything is relative. So it doesn't necessarily mean that Valentino Rossi is going to jump in a Formula One car and be the best Formula One racer ever. Only one guy ever has won championships in both MotoGP and Formula One, and that's the famous John Surtees. Valentino Rossi would very much like to be the next guy to do it. I think that's still somewhat haunting him in the back of his mind, but he's got a MotoGP career to finish up, and that's going to happen first. So we're going to have to see that. And even if Rossi did move over to Formula One, and it would be years down the road, in my opinion, and I will go out on a limb and I'm going to put in an advanced prediction that he's not going to make the Formula One championship. Because they're different skill sets. It takes a different sort of physical readiness and mental ability and just everything. You know, it's a different discipline. It's entirely different stuff. So that's covering our ship to shore conversation that we had last week. That was good stuff. Then we had a question, and this is something that's come up now and then about MotoGP 101, sort of the beginning stuff about MotoGP. And Bob, the show tends to be for, you know, big race fans that are already very knowledgeable, blah, blah, blah. And this is true. And this is what the show is targeted at, is that, the, you know, somebody that is not the absolute beginning race fan. I do occasionally kind of talk about beginnery stuff or whatever, but it tends to be somewhat at advanced level. I assume you know who the riders are. I assume you know the teams, that sort of thing. And that's just an assumption I make because that's the show and that's the way I'm doing it. But Rob Campbell had a question. He's talking. He says, my wife and I were watching the Phillip Island race, and she asked me a question that I didn't really have an answer to. I had my guess answers, but I was not really sure. She asked, is every race 27 laps long? He says, I can't remember the exact number of laps of Phillip Island, so it's a fake number there, which I should have checked, being a prepared host, but I did not. I just opened the email and started reading it. So the Phillip Island Grand Prix was, I don't know exactly how many laps, but I'll tell you what, the Pelini Malaysian Motorcycle Grand Prix was 21 laps, 116.5 kilometers. So, back to Rob's email. He says, his wife says, has ever raced 27 laps? He says, no, it was 22 laps last week, and again, another fake number. So her question and his is, how or what determines the number of laps for a circuit? She thought that the teams had to ride a certain amount of miles in a race season. Any answers or input? And basically, Rob, your wife hit the nail on the head. The races are determined by distance, or actually more accurately, let's say, by time. They want a race to last the appropriate amount of time for a television broadcast, which is going to be about 45 minutes. So they will usually, on a faster circuit, you might have a little bit less distance, or excuse me, a little bit more distance than you would have on a slower circuit. But by and large, that race is always going to last roughly the same amount of time, somewhere in about the 45-odd minute range, because it fits into a TV schedule. So yes, at some circuits, it's going to be a little longer in terms of number of laps. Some circuits going to be a little bit fewer laps. So thanks very much, Rob Campbell, for that question. And then the last thing this is talking about before we jump into a real quick Valencia preview, the times that you're going to need to watch MotoGP. If you want to watch MotoGP live this weekend when they're at Valencia, you're going to have to pay attention to the daylight savings time switch. When here in the United States, we're doing that Sunday morning, which is actually before the MotoGP race. In fact, it's actually during the whole day between the 125 and the 250 race, which might well mean that one of those races will be broadcast twice, or that you'll have to have a time machine or a spaceship or some damn thing or something, because you got the time change going on. Basically, going into that weekend, we are 8 hours behind Spain, and when we after we do the time change, we're going to be a 9-hour time difference. So pay attention to that. Make sure that you realize exactly what time you're wanting to watch your MotoGP. I predict that it'll be 5 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, or 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on Sunday morning is when it'll be live. Speed TV is showing it in the afternoon. They're listing 3 p.m. Pacific, which is 6 p.m. Eastern, for their MotoGP time. However, again, I'm not 100% sure if that takes the time change into account, so you might want to pay attention to that. So, all right, that's going to do it for the intro. Why don't we go ahead and talk a little bit about Valencia, and then we'll jump into those interviews and call with Thomas. It's really good stuff. I think you're going to enjoy it. Before we get into that Valencia preview, I do want a quick news story that just broke. Late breaking news from MotoGPOD. Max Biaggi has got himself a superbike ride, World Superbike, with the Sterogarda Ducati team. He'll be racing along with Ruben Chaus for that team, because it's, as you all know, his time there on the Corona Alstari team has come to an end. He quit there 2 weeks ago or so after things sort of started falling apart because of the typical Max difficulty to get along with Francis Biada, the leader of that thing, and the withdrawal of the main sponsor, Corona Beer, kind of left them without the wherewithal to pay Max's demands of salary. And he had tried to get a ride in MotoGP, and that came to naught. So he's got himself lined up another superbike ride next season, riding a 1098 Ducati. should be good stuff alongside Ruben Chaos, and we hope for the best for Max, because despite his faults and everything else, I do miss him from MotoGP. I think Max has a lot of character that he brings to racing, and he's an interesting guy in his own Maxi way, and we do enjoy having him around. So it's good to see that he'll at least be back in World Superbike. And also, let's see, talking about Valencia, we are coming into the final race of the season. This is one of the fantastic races of the season. Valencia is a great little circuit with that stadium sort of seating. You can almost see the whole circuit, supposedly, from all the hills surrounding it. Last year, if you'll remember, it was a super exciting race with Nicky Hayden going in there, down on points to Valentino Rossi, but managing to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. And Rossi's misfortune was Hayden's gain, and it was a fantastic race last year, and I look for a good race this year, too. It's a standalone race. It has no bearing whatsoever on the championship, but it will still be a good event to watch and very, very enjoyable. So we're looking forward to that because, and this is stealing some crib notes here from the Yamaha press release, because they have the best sort of track notes that they do, and this one actually has a couple of entertaining comments that I have to share. So we're talking about, a challenging first season of 800cc Grand Prix racing comes to an end this weekend as the 18th and final round of the 2007 MotoGP World Championship takes place at Valencia in Spain. Okay, 15th place or above would leave Rossi out of reach of Danny Pedrosa, who has to win the race to maintain any chance of usurping the Italian for the, now this is the part that I liked, for the coveted second spot in the final standings. That's creative writing, folks. Unfortunately, newsflash, nobody except people with steel trap minds like Jules remembers who came in second in any given year and all of that sort of thing. They remember the champion. And I'm not knocking Rossi. This guy is a well-deserved reputation as the greatest of all time and all of that good stuff. Because if he gets on the podium this time, it will be his 100th podium appearance, first rider ever in the 58-year history of premier class Grand Prix racing to reach 100 podium finishes. And this was a really interesting statistic. The Valencia Grand Prix, it's the 100th race since the new era of four-stroke MotoGP was introduced in 2002. And here you go. It marks a special landmark for Rossi because he's one of only three riders to have appeared in every single one, taking 49 victories along the way. So pretty much darn near 50%. You know, if you're strictly speaking, I guess it'd be 49% of the races he won, not appeared on the podium, but flat out won in the since the four-stroke era began. So this is testament to Rossi's talents and abilities and all of that. And he may have not had the absolute best season in Rossi terms for 2007, but he certainly didn't do too shabby, because second in the championship, yes, nonetheless, nobody might remember it. And a few years down the road and all that, they will remember it when it's Rossi. But it's, you know, you were almost there, dude, that kind of a thing. So Casey just had a better season this year. Next year is going to be a totally different story. So back to Valencia. Let's go ahead and do our preview, since that's what we're actually doing. Valencia is somewhat unusual track for MotoGP. It's run clockwise. It's very tight and twisty track, but it has a nice front straight, nice long front straight, and a fantastic long looping left-hander fast entry into that turn one there at the end of the straight. And this all is totally different from the small, slow corners that we have, the flip-flop chicanes and all of that throughout the infield. So it's a track of different sort of extremes, where you have, you know, the long front straight and you have a couple of really, really fast corners in there and that sort of thing. And then you have some, tight, slow, twisty bits as well. But it's a good track. Always some good racing there at Valencia. I'm really looking forward to it. Both Honda and Yamaha have won three races in the premier class at Valencia, with Suzuki and Ducati each holding a single victory. Last year's MotoGP race at Valencia was the first ever 1-2 for Ducati. These, by the way, are some statistics that I cribbed off MotoGP.com. I'm sure they won't mind. And Casey Stoner scored his first ever Grand Prix victory at Valencia in the 125 class in 2003, riding an Aprilia. Danny Pedrosa won the 125cc race and the 250cc race. A victory in Valencia for Pedrosa would make him the first rider to have won in all three classes at the Ricardo Tormo Circo. That's interesting. I didn't realize that. Marco Melandri's done well here. John Hopkins has not had a top 10 finish in any of his five visits to Valencia. His best result is 11th, which he got in 2002, riding the two-stroke Yamaha, and then last year riding for Suzuki. Chris Vermeulen did not finish last year after running off the track due to gear selection problems. It's the only time in the last 30 MotoGP races that Vermeulen has failed to reach the finish line of a race. Another impressive record. We have such a depth of talent on the field. We really do. These guys are all great. Loris Caparossi twice finished on the podium in the last 4 years at Valencia, third place in 2003 and second last year. Yada, yada, yada. Nicky Hayden, batting roughly 500, has finished on the podium for the last 2 years at Valencia. However, he crashed on his previous two visits to the circuit. So we're looking for a good performance from Hayden, actually. I shouldn't make light of him. Let's see who else we got. Oh, wow. Randy Dequinier's current points total of 101 is the highest ever achieved by a Kawasaki rider in the MotoGP class. Interesting stuff. And if Chaz Davis does not finish in the top 15 in Valencia, meaning if Chaz Davis does not score a point in Valencia, it will be the first time since in the entire history of MotoGP, since the Grand Prix series started in 1949, it will be the first time that there's been a full season without a British racer scoring points in the Premier class. So, Chaz, it's up to you. You're the lone British guy. You've got to make sure you score a point out there so that at least we have 1 point going to a British guy for the 2007 season. That's some pressure right there. Another thing that's happening at Valencia, and this is kind of cool, and alert MotoGPOD listener and friend in Japan, Yoshi Uchiyama, sent me in this and telling me about this. He says, happy news from Japan. Taka Nakagami, whose Takaaki is his first full name, has got a chance to ride as a wild card in the Valencia Grand Prix in the 125cc class. He's only 15 years old. He won the Japanese 125cc title last year, winning all six races in the championship. He is now one of the MotoGP Academy racers, and he's currently sixth in the Spanish championship, in which he came in third in July at Valencia, and then he won September's Valencia race there in the Spanish championship. Got his link up to his website, and I'll tell you, Taka Nakagami, it's a little bit telling about how racing has become when, you know, a 15-year-old guy racing has a website of this caliber, but you got to check it out. It's awesome. I'm putting a link up on the website. It's taka-nakagami.com. Link to it on the MotoGPOD website, motogpod.com. And this website, I'm not the biggest fan of flash and movement and music that instantly plays and all that sort of things on websites. I prefer, you know, text. Give me the information. I will sort of go through it. And if I care to watch some sort of video or something, I will click on that link. But this website is so well done. It's so professional, so classy, and it's really very, very impressive. And I think it's somewhat telling that a 15-year-old racing in the 125cc class has a website of this nature. So thanks very much, Yoshi, for sending us that link and reminding me of the news that he will be racing there as a wild card. I think that's cool stuff, and I think we will be seeing a lot more of Taka Nakagami. So that's our Valencia preview, such as it is. Don't forget to watch the race. Come on down to MotoGPOD.com or RideOn2.com. Join us in the chat room there Sunday morning, early, early Sunday morning. I may not be making an appearance. We're going to see. I have some stuff going on and everything. I might not be up that early. But Jules, I'm sure, will be there because Jules never sleeps. And there will be a bunch of other people there. And it's always fun. It's always interesting. If nothing else, you can just type, wow, did you see that? And that sort of thing in the chat room while you talk to other MotoGP fans. And as we all know, sometimes it's difficult to find people that you know that could talk about MotoGP with because it's that kind of sport. But moving on, let's get on with our next section of the show. All right, I've got Thomas Reynolds on the phone today. Thomas is a freelance moto journalist in Australia who's been covering MotoGP this year along with quite a few other things, and he contacted me. He was nice enough to agree to a phone call. So how are you today, Thomas?
I'm well, thank you, Bob. It's mid-afternoon here in Australia, and we've just gone to daylight savings, so kind of like the most exciting time of the year, really, when we head into this nice weather and what have you.
I'll bet, yes. It's your springtime and everything. You're looking into some fantastic weather soon, huh?
Absolutely. Well, we must apologise for Phillip Island. Anyone who comes out here every time is always shocked at how cold it does get down in the southern regions of the state that I live in. But yes, it can be certainly a changeable place nonetheless.
Right. Yeah, I think Julian Ryder said something about all four seasons in one day. And but yeah, you're right down at the south. It's very close to Antarctica, comparatively speaking. And yeah, it's going to get a bit chilly.
Correct. Well, the late Barry Sheen once said, "Welcome to Phillip Island, the gateway to hypothermia." So it was never better word spoken about it. But the thing about Phillip Island, of course, is that is part of the interest and the excitement of it. It is a very picturesque circuit, but it does face right down there on the south. And if the cold front does come up from Antarctica way, it can go from what is it in your scale, 90-odd degrees down to, well, probably 50 or 60 in just a few minutes. So you can imagine what a huge change you can get there.
Right, right. Better pack along some extra clothes to do the layers thing and all of that.
Well,
I suppose.
I always say to people, take shorts, t-shirt, but make sure you bring your gear that you would take to the snow, and you'll be absolutely sorted.
And a big backpack to carry it all around in.
Damn right.
Yeah. So you were fortunate enough to cover the Phillip Island, the Australian Grand Prix down there. You got to do quite a bit of interviews with all the Australian riders. Why don't we talk a little bit about that? First of all, everybody says Casey Stoner somewhat of a difficult interview because he's so reticent, I suppose might be a good term. What do you think of that?
I think it's very true for mainstream media organisations. We get a lot. I was in a press conference, which I think the listeners will hear some of, where you can hear Casey's being asked questions that are so inane that he starts to clam up. So I sort of jump in and ask him some questions that may be of relevance or interest. So, for example, when he gets asked, he fell off at the hay shed and they said, "Oh, is that the first time you've crashed this year?" He just looked over with this stupid, what a stupid question that is. Because we all know he's fallen off a couple of times in practice. But Casey, rather than taking the path of saying, "Well, I haven't fallen off in a race, but yes, I've had a couple of falls in practice," just looked at him with a shut the hell up look. And so if you ask the questions that show you've done no research, it tends to get Casey's back up. But the reality is MotoGP, and you guys would understand this, is it's not a big sport until you get a world champion. And then the mainstream media get on board, but it's not like they do any hardcore work to find out these things. So if you ask Casey good questions, you get good responses. But if you ask him inane questions, you get similarly inane answers.
Huh. I'll have to keep that in mind. Should I get a chance to talk with him myself? No.
Well, I was very lucky. I got to we had a public appearance here for Casey in Melbourne, Australia, which is my hometown, and I got to host his appearance before he came on, and we got about 1,500 people there. It was very late notice, but he came out, and I've got to say the look on his face was pure shock, because he was just surprised that people are beginning to adore him and beginning to, they don't just know who he is, but they know his career now, and they're starting to really, he's developing this fan base back in Australia, and you can tell he's just totally shocked by this.
Do you think he's going to start having the problems of fan recognition where it makes it difficult to sort of live a normal life in Australia, or has he already had that happening?
No, I don't think that's going to be the case. Where he's from, Kurri is a little country town, and I can imagine a lot of the boys up there would take great pride in pretending they don't even know what he's been up to. So, yeah, it's also not the Australian way. We tend to we'll yell and scream at an event, but if we saw him in the street, it might be just a quiet nod. He certainly wouldn't be having to do what Valentino did and, leave Italy. Or I read today Lewis Hamilton's moving to Switzerland, so it's not the same sort of scene out here.
Right, right. That's good. That's I always feel a bit sorry for these guys where they're living the – somewhat living a dream, and then the price that they pay for that is that fame, and it just I don't know, it doesn't strike me as all that good. So,
well, some take to it. I mean, I know Christopher Mullen is just completely unaffected. He's always, he's what we describe in Australia as a good bloke, and he just maintains that, whether he's, you turn the microphone off and he talks as if it's still going. He's the same person one way or the other, so whereas Casey tends to, no one really knows what he's truly like. I think we're certainly seeing this year he's getting a little bit. Look, the thing between him and Valentino is definitely growing in terms of a angst, Sete Gibbenau sort of thing, and I think next year we'll really see that kick into high gear.
I agree. I think that that's somewhat been brewing along, that we've somewhat seen that a little bit. And it also does strike me that Stoner, and not in a bad way, I'm not saying this in a bad way, but that he's a good corporate rider. So now he's with Ducati's big factory. He seems to be putting on the company face. And I mean, in a lot of ways, this is these guys' job, and they're sort of supposed to do that. But it does mean that you don't necessarily know exactly what answer you're going to get when you talk to him.
Yeah, but the other thing is I think he's personally playing into Valentino's hands. We all know Valentino said things in the press in the past just to get a rise out of people or to get a reaction, and Casey's falling for it at the moment. And what he needs to do is, I mean, if I was advising him as a media person, I would be saying, whenever Valentino baits you, talk about someone else. Talk about how you think your biggest threat next year will come from Pedrosa or Jorge Lorenzo. Talk about Valentino like he's yesterday's man, and rather than going toe-to-toe with him, because, you know, Valentino just has let slip in the press that he thinks Casey only won because of the bike and tyres. So, of course, they ask him that question and Casey gets his back up about not getting enough respect. Silly move. He should just ignore that.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Speaking of teammates and all of that, how do you think Casey's going to get along next year with Marco Melandri?
Well, it'll be an interesting thing because I think this year we all thought that Caparossi would continue on his merry way and be a top five rider, and Casey would do okay, but I think there's no doubt you guys must be surprised that in the American community, but over here we're really shocked that Casey's gone and won this thing. So it'll be difficult because Casey's clearly going to be the incumbent number one rider, but Marco on paper is probably the better credentialed rider. And yet, you know, Casey's going to be coming off a MotoGP championship. So it'll be interesting to see how Ducati play it. I imagine they'll back Casey all the way, but Marco deserves every little bit of assistance he can get. So I don't know how that'll be in terms of a 1-2 rider team, which, as we see in most of the teams, they do have.
Mm-hmm. Right, I agree. It's going to be actually a formidable team, very, very formidable. So talking a bit about Christopher Mühlen, when you mentioned that he's a very likable guy and very sort of real and genuine, how do you think things have shaped out for him this season with Suzuki and looking at his performance and his close battle with John Hopkins? But, what are your kind of thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, Chris has had the breakthrough. He's had a win. Much to his annoyance, it was in the wet. I actually mentioned that. I said, when he qualified poorly at Phillip Island, I said, you must be praying for rain. He said, oh, on the one hand, I am. But on the other hand, if I win in the rain, I'm gone. Everyone's going to just talk about the duck boy, how he's only ever good in the rain. So for Chris, it's going to be really important that he pulls out a win in the dry next year. No matter when, what time of year it is, obviously he'd like it in the early part of the season. But if he just keeps doing well in the wet, he's going to start to cop it a little bit more, I think. And from himself, he's very determined to get a win in the dry.
Right, and I think that is something that can dog a rider where they get that reputation as a wet specialist.
Ask Westy.
Yeah,
and West is not he's in the same sort of bin at the moment. So, which it must be, is a little bit unusual. I mean, you think of Australia, we are the driest continent on earth, but all our riders are really crackingly good in the wet, and that's down to dirt track, which obviously some of the American riders come from that background as well.
Right. They're just the reduced traction. It's a somewhat similar feel. Yeah. And all the All the Australians have dirt track backgrounds now, don't they? Yeah, I'm not so sure.
We don't do any mini moto out here. Just about. I don't know of any circuits. There's a little bit of mini moto racing, but it's actually mostly older riders, not the the really young kids. So when you see photos of Valentino as a 10-year-old racing mini moto, the photos of Casey and all the other guys at the same age, they're all on motocross bikes. So it's completely different backgrounds, really.
Right, and actually somewhat more similar to the traditional way here in the States, although we are you're seeing more and more mini road racing sort of things cropping up here and there. Now, with Vermeulen, though, he's also got a bit of the – it's not just – he's got a win this year. He's got several podiums, a couple seconds, a third or two. But he's doing well for Suzuki. So, Suzuki is also – this is new for them. So, I think that Suzuki is going to want to have a win in the dry quite as much as Vermeulen is.
We've seen for a long time now Suzuki, they've made probably the best road bike over the last 10 years in the superbike category, and for them not to go and make a MotoGP bike that's going to, go out there and get a few wins has been quite extraordinary. So I think they're finally, well, you hate to say catching up, because technology-wise they've got, the pneumatic valve engine, they've got the good electronics, they've got the good tyres. On paper they should be going out there and winning a heap of races, and I think it's a real shame Hopkins is leaving. I think the poor bloke has been through all that crap when Suzuki were just, we all saw him kick the bike that time, and now he's leaving just at a time when I think they can actually show something, and probably show a lot more than Kawasaki will next year too.
Yeah, I'm of two minds on that one. I mean, I do agree. I think that was a bit of a mistake, but I also think that the Kawasaki may have been suffering, and no offense to Ant West, who's doing quite well for his, considering he started late in the season and all that, but that the Kawasaki needs the right rider. And next year, that brings us to talking, you know, full circle here of the Australians talking with Ant West prospects for next year.
Well, Ant West, he's the prodigal child of Australian motorcycle racing, maybe more so than Anthony Gobert or a couple other names along the way. But Ant West, as I said to him in my interview, which I, once again I hope the listeners get to hear, was I opened with, well, Ant, if Casey Stoner's had a weird year, you can actually top that with your weird year, because I don't think I've ever seen a guy score points in three different categories in the same year, apart from the era when they all raced in all the GP classes. But because he scored points in the 250 World Supers and World Super Sport and MotoGP. So, you know, Ant was really staring down the barrel of coming back to Australia and finding a job as a labourer, more than likely, and boom, back in MotoGP. So, extraordinary year for him. And I think, in terms of raw talent, he's probably the most talented of the three Australian riders, but in terms of application, he'd be at the back.
Hmm, interesting. So do you think with some suitable development, has he got the right team, the right coaches and things like that for to make his next season a good one, with to bring that talent to the fore?
Bob, I don't think he does. I think he's going to have a pretty average year. I mean, he'll show out, but Ant's like Casey was at 16, heaps of talent, but I think he's going to throw it away from time to time. We've seen him get the head of steam in the wet there in the first race, and I don't know, I just worry about Ant, because I don't think, you know, I don't think it's any secret now his father was arrested at the MotoGP race for getting in a fight on the Friday, so I don't know, with that sort of backing, I'd be concerned for his well-being and his state of mind for next year, to be honest.
Interesting, yeah, and I talked about that a bit on the show with his father, and I mean, in some ways it's like, you know, the father is sort of defending the son's honor kind of a thing, and you know, hope it all turns out okay, but yeah, I also see your point of view, where you're coming from on that.
Well, I can't picture Chris Vermeulen's dad going the knuckle with anyone, put it that way.
No, yeah, so.
it's just not their style. But, I mean, that may be what works for Ant, the bit of the street fighter image. But to be honest, he's had enough of those wild days, and he really just needs to get a solid preseason on that Kawasaki. I might add, it's his first preseason with a factory team, or indeed just about any team, for 5 years. He's always been signed at the 11th hour by most teams. So to see him going ahead next year in a on a good ride and with a bit of pre-season. Look, that does all go well for him, but I tell you, all the guys in the media room down at MotoGP were all thinking one and the same thing, that he's going to have a problem next year. But, you know, hopefully that's a spur under his, you know, gives him a bit of a spur on to actually prove us all wrong, because let's face it, Casey proved us all grievously wrong. Wayne Gardner came out and said, oh, that Casey was immature and would crash and have a terrible year. Well, he's had to actually chew his words, and we're happier for that. We're happy we've had to chew our words.
Yeah, I'll bet. I mean, it was. If you judge at the beginning of the season, it was. You know, you think Casey Stoner, wow, you know, he was a bit of a crash fest last year. But no, he's...
Yeah, well, even when he was doing well, Bob, we all expected him to fall away. Not fall off necessarily, but I think everyone was just waiting for Valentino to get his act together and go out and win. And just at the races, when you thought that Valentino would come good, he didn't. And now this end of season dominance is just incredible. I mean, we'd have to back Casey this weekend in Valencia as well.
I agree. I definitely do agree. It seems like that Yamaha's problems, there's a variety of issues going on, and they just it hasn't clicked, and it doesn't look like it's going to for the last race of the season. So, yeah.
Just one quick interesting note on Yamaha. There was no doubt in my mind that they wanted Casey at one stage. I know I spoke to Jeremy Burgess, who, if you ever get the chance, Bob, interview him, he'll tie you in knots and spit you out the other end. He's a really prickly character to talk to. But I asked him when Casey was first going to LCR Honda if he thought that would be a good move for him. And he said, oh, Casey's got options in MotoGP if he didn't take that up. And if he's got options this year, he'll have options next year. And I said, does that mean you'd be interested in him? He said, oh, there are many teams that are interested in him. He was basically giving me a nod and a wink that Yamaha would have taken him this year possibly. So, you know, it's sort of strange to us, because I always considered that Casey would come on good in a couple of years, but this early is just ridiculous.
Right. And hopefully he can follow that up and doesn't end up being somewhat of a, you know, the one-hit wonder, where he has a fantastic season and then for whatever reason it's not clicking next year. But I don't think that'll be the case, because I don't think it's that this year that it's everybody, either every other team has gotten it wrong and that Ducati's gotten it right. It's so much as every other team is sort of doing okay, but that the Ducati team effort is very good, and that Stoner is very, very good on top of that, and that Caparossi's performance is sort of emphasizes that he's just doing okay, you know, but Stoner is doing fantastically well on the same motorcycle, and I think that's testament to his ability.
It's interesting to me to see that the 250 riders are really the best place to ride the 800, and in fact, it would seem in Caparossi's case that just having had 4 or so years riding a 990 is a disadvantage coming down to the 800. And if it's a disadvantage to have ridden a 990, then it's going to be a huge disadvantage to be a superbike rider. So, you know, in Australia, like America, our number one race category is superbike, and we're really going to struggle to produce the quality of riders. We may have the likes of Casey, if he can be consistent, you know, have 10 years of pretty high-level stuff, but I think personally we're certainly going to struggle to produce good riders, because a lot of our good riders now just want to go and race AMA. They want to follow Matt Ladin's steps. So it's going to be an interesting time in terms of what countries produce the best riders in the next 5 or 7 years as well.
Yeah, I agree. Do you think we're going to start seeing a very serious shift towards European champions and
Well, it's their background, and unless, you know, you say that you've got some mini-moto racing there, but, you know, take, for example, do you have a decent 125 GP title race series in the US?
Oh, they have the US GPRU, which is quite small. AMA has done away with all of their 250, and they, I don't know when the last time they had a 125 series. So other than that, it's all at the club level, and you know, there are quite local, regional things that aren't bad opportunities, but there's not too much beyond, you know, the sort of, you know, I don't know, 5 or 6 circuits, perhaps, probably less than
that. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, look, in Australia, we get a dozen regular entrants in the 125 categories, and most of them are over the age of 20. So, you know, the kids just want to jump straight onto a 600 now. They want to go straight from like a 125 or similar, or even the little Honda 125 four-stroke racing category we've got now, straight into 600s, because they see superbikes as a way to make money in Australia and survive, whereas 125s is the path to the top level. And if you look at the, you know, the European 125s in Spain and Germany and the UK, they're still very strong categories, and they're the ones that are providing new riders into 125 and 250cc GP, and in turn onto MotoGP. So we're really going to struggle. Well, I don't know what the plan is, frankly. I think we're going to be in a whole lot of trouble in the next 5 years.
Hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting tick. Do you have graduated licensing in Australia?
What, in terms of racing or just general riding licenses?
General street riding licenses.
Yeah, yeah, we're limited in the first few years, but like America, we have different states with different laws, so it varies a little bit. But our license generally is you've got to be 18 years old, a bit older here, but our drinking age is 18 as well, so you lose on the swings, but you pick up on the roundabouts.
Good way to put it. The reason that comes up is I think that those laws tend to be a bit beneficial because they force you to ride a smaller motorcycle, and you know, kids being what they are, they're going to get the most out of that smaller motorcycle. And here in America, I don't know of any of the states that require, you know, that you can basically be a, you know, 16 or maybe 18 in some states, whatever it is, a year old boy, and go down and buy an R1. And I think that's a big mistake, but it is the way it is. And I think that the graduated licenses that are so common in Europe, and apparently also and somewhat in Australia, tend to make better riders.
Yeah, well, look, our laws here vary a little bit. In where I'm in Victoria, the state of Victoria, we're allowed to ride anything up to 250 for the first 12 months, and then you progress from there. I might also add we have another probationary period on top of that that provides for zero blood alcohol for the first 3 years. So if you're caught with any alcohol in your system, you lose your license, which basically trains young drivers and riders to never drink before they go for a drive. And if you look at the stats, certainly in where I am, even riders who are under the legal limit but have some alcohol in their system are overrepresented in the deaths. So my general rule is never have a single drink before you go for a ride, because it just helps to keep those reflexes sharp, which is, as we know, we need when there's car drivers out there seemingly bent on destruction.
Oh, yeah, I agree. It's one of my rules that I'm happy to say that I have never broken. And, yeah, you know, the driving a car, you know, well, you know, 2 beers, 2 hours, whatever, that sort of thing, I'll be fine. You know, but no, I wouldn't do that with a motorcycle.
So. But you can drink and podcast, apparently, mate.
Yes, apparently.
I've been listening. So, so just getting back to Ant West, just quickly on Ant. My feeling is that next year, as I said, he'll have a bit of a struggle of a year, but he'll also probably win a race, which will be an interesting outcome for him, because, you know, if it rains, he's just such a demon. And if he gets a good off-season on that thing, he's going to be really, really strangely up there. And then at the back of the pack, he could be the next, I don't know, who's the most inconsistent rider at the moment? Colin Edwards, maybe? I don't know.
Colin's actually been consistently pretty poor, except in qualifying. I would almost say... It seems to be, initial hunch is, it tends to be Marco Melandri is a bit of a random number generator this year. So that's what I've been saying.
Or Depunier, or he's been a bit all over the shop as well.
We, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, in fact, those sort of riders are good for the series because they just come out of nowhere, usually around contract time. I'm looking at you, Carlos Checa, and suddenly put out a good performance when you think they've had a pretty mediocre year. But, yeah, so that sort of wraps up the Aussies in terms of what I think they're going to be doing next year. I think Casey will probably go on and win this title again next year based on his current performance. But, gee, it's a bit of a raffle with the off-seasons now. Everything is changing so much and certainly if the rumours that we heard down here that Valentino goes to Bridgestone next year, well then, well, I don't know what'll happen.
Right, exactly. Who knows, though? Michelin may get it right sometime or another. You know what I'm saying? There's a lot going to happen between now and then.
Yeah, there was one very interesting press conference I thought I'd let you in on, which was the post-qualifying press conference when they were hopping into Valentino, and the European press can be really quite aggressive, you know, the Italian and Spanish press asking him point blank if Michelin didn't deliver, would he swap to Bridgestone, and could it end up in a situation where he's on Bridgestones but Jorge Lorenzo's on Michelin's, and would that be, and finally they asked Jorge, what do you think, Jorge, and he said, I just hope my Dunlop's tomorrow are halfway good. So all power to him, you know, he was just not prepared to play that game because they're trying to suck him into this MotoGP press conference game and the guy hasn't even had a ride on one yet.
Right, exactly. And, yeah, that's going to be its own whole fireworks session, is the Lorenzo and Rossi teammate thing that I think is already also being shaped up somewhat in the press, somewhat in real life, to make the that's...
I think Jorge will have his measure. I think Jorge, to be honest, I think Casey's going to be the one more likely to have a slanging match, whereas Jorge will just treat it all with a pinch of salt because he seems the most, for a European rider, he seems really Nicky Hayden-ish, laid back and, yeah, whatever, dude, it doesn't bother me.
Interesting. Okay. I'll have to keep a better eye on him. That's not necessarily a side that I would have thought, but I suppose you're right. You know, it makes a certain amount of sense. Speaking of teammates and going back to Ant West, how do you think he and Hopkins are going to get along?
Well, in many ways, they're a bit the same, similar sometimes. I mean, John's got a cooler head on his shoulders, but boy, when John pops his, when he pops a fuse, he really pops it big time. So I think they'll be interesting teammates, but as I said, normally you work better when you're a bit fire and ice, when you've got two riders of different temperaments. We've seen, you know, Alonso and Hamilton this year who are, you know, Hamilton's probably the more reserved of the two, but they've had problems within the team, probably their biggest talking point. Colin Edwards has always got along well with Valentino, but part of that could be put to the fact that Colin's never beaten him. So Valentino's always your friend as long as you don't beat him. So in terms of John and Ant West, results will play a really important role in the way their relationship matures or whatever. There's no doubt you can see now that Hopkins and Vermeulen are kind of, I wouldn't say battling, but there's a little bit of I really want to beat him in this last race feel for this weekend.
Right.
So, I don't know. I think Ant generally gets along well with people, but he sometimes says things that he doesn't realise have repercussions later. So he could end up saying something inadvertently that offends Hopkins, and then it'll be on for young and old.
Right. Yeah, he might have to grow into that and watch it.
As long as we see Johnny Hopkins popping those big stand-up wheelies this year, I'll be a happy man. He is the master of the vertical wheelie.
Yes, the 12 o'clocker across the line and sort of a thing.
Brilliant.
Exactly. Yeah.
Fantastic to watch.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah.
Has Hopkins been sharing data much with Vermeulen? I'm not sure if that's something that's driven by the team or if the riders do that. Or,
well, in terms of the way the team behave, I think once Hopkins announced he was going to Kawasaki, he may have found himself in a bit on the outer. I mean, it happens to all teams, and it's a normal, sensible thing, really, that you just don't give the guy who's leaving too much stuff or data or information or even technology to take to the new company. And that's one of the things that's always surprised me about the silly season, is that people do announce where they're going really early, and I think they compromise their ability to complete the season the best they can. I don't know if that's your feeling on it, but I would rather see the silly season have an official start on the Monday after Valencia.
Yeah, that would be nice. I'm not 100% sure how they would be able to monitor
Well, they could mandate it. I mean, they do it in various football codes. They have a trading season and an official time when the announcements are made. You can have secret deals going on, but I'd rather see the public announcements start the week after the season's over. Give us a chance to enjoy the racing for what it is and make sure that the riders feel they're getting their best possible support.
Yeah, actually, that does make a lot of sense. And you could, just like they monitor, say, college-level sports here. You know, I mean, and of course, there's always going to be abuses, but then you find those abuses and take action. So, yeah, that is a good idea.
Yeah, better than a single tire rule anyway.
Oh, yes. I'm so glad that one went away.
Yeah. Oh, look, there was, you know, that was just – the way that came about is just ridiculous. Michelin have one bad year and everyone's crying from the top of the mountain, we must have a single tire rule. It's absurd.
Right, I agree. It's the whole thing, and it's somewhat. The beginning of it, when it first started, thinking, well, it's just a way to get Bridgestone and Michelin to agree to the new set of tire rules. Then it started looking more and more like a possibility. I started getting nervous, and now it's gone away, and I'm much happier again. So, frankly, but. Well, all right. We've gone quite a bit over what we said because I know you're a bit pressed for time.
So. That's all right.
But it's been great to have you on the show, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again, and we will be playing those interviews you were kind enough to provide after this. And so thanks a lot. I do appreciate having you on the show, Thomas.
Well, I'll stay in touch with you guys because I always go down to Phillip Island testing. Nothing weirder than going down in January in the middle of our hot summer to testing with five other people sitting in the crowd at Phillip Island. All the grandstands gone. It's a barren place at that time, but very entertaining to go down and have a chat to the riders. So I'll see if I can catch you guys some interviews at that stage as well.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. We'd love to hear it.
No problem at all. Cheers.
Let's listen to this press conference and interview that Thomas was kind enough to provide for us. He managed to work out the release of the rights from the rights holder there in Australia and allow us to play him. He's got, like I said, a press conference. First of all, it's the Thomas Reynolds with a whole bunch of other Australian journalists present. But, of course, Thomas asks the good questions, so listen for those. And then we're going to follow that up with Thomas interviewing Ant West, just him, along with an in-house journalist from the Motorcycling Australia National Race Organization. And the first question is a bit drowned out in the scraping of chairs and muttering and whatnot, but as near as I could tell, a journalist asked Casey a question about being his first time back on the bike since Motegi and since he picked up the championship, and how did things go? So we'll launch into Casey's answer and then go on from there.
No, everything's gone pretty good today. We had a really good feeling with the whole bike and the whole package, and you know, I suppose the Phillip Island test at the beginning of the season really started well for us, and I think that's where we started to pick up from. So to come back here now with more knowledge and more experience with the bike and tyres, I think we just sort of picked up where we left off and taken another step forward.
Can you sort of see the spill, Paxi? A couple of minutes to go, it didn't seem to be captured on camera, that's all.
You saw Chaz's crash?
Yeah, same way.
Identical.
So what was it? Was it like a little gust of wind? Not a little one, but a big one?
No, it's not a gust of wind. You don't get things like that from a gust of wind or a puddle of water. So there had to have been something on the track because there was absolutely no reason why the rear would go. I mean, Chaz did exactly the same thing. We weren't on full angle, and then all of a sudden it went, so there's no drama.
So you just sort of wiped that one from your mind and think, well, it ain't going to happen again?
Pretty much.
Is that the first time you've gone off this year?
No.
How many times have you gone off the bike?
Don't know, and I don't care.
Casey, how the conditions here today are obviously very different from testing pre-season. Is there anything you can take from that, or are you really sort of starting from scratch?
We definitely started with the setting we had at testing. I mean, testing was a little bit warmer, so the conditions were a bit better for tyres and everything, the way it performed. It was a little bit difficult today, especially with it going, you know, sort of wet and dry all the time. But yeah, we started with the same setting we had in testing, and then we've just changed a couple of things for this afternoon session, which improved it. But also the wind was a lot worse than testing, and we're sort of struggling, but at the same time, we've got a new fairing this weekend that we've tested the past couple of races. This is the first time we're using it, and it seems to be working really well.
Is this the small fairing that was tested from that?
Yeah, because we had a problem in Assen earlier in the year that, you know, I was sort of getting blown wide a little bit on the corners, and I went out the first part of this afternoon session with the old fairing, and I was sort of getting blown all over the track, and then we went out with the new fairing, and it felt like a different bike. So, you know, I'm pretty impressed with the way things come up.
Casey, how different is this meeting for you on the basis that it's your first as world champion and then it's your home Grand Prix as well?
I don't believe any more important than another race. I mean, of course the last race was pretty important for us, but we still had another three to win the championship. You know, it wasn't a do or die effort last weekend. And it's the same for this weekend. I mean, it's calculated risk. We do all we can in the practice sessions, same as we do every weekend. And, you know, it'd just be really nice to sort of top the season off, I suppose, with a win here.
Having won first world championship, people, I guess, are going to eventually be talking about, as they do, multiple world championships, a la Rossi doing. Can that be done today's day and age?
I believe it can. I mean, you know, I'm going to have to train harder and work harder than everybody else to do it, but, you know, I think I've got the team behind me, the tire company behind me to, you know, really work hard, and same as myself. And, you know, we can do it again next year and hopefully, you know, more years to come, but, you know, we have to concentrate, I suppose, over pre-season testing to get the best package we can to start the season out.
So, 5, 6, 7?
We'll see if we can even do 2 yet.
A lot's been said about your consistency this year compared to other years. Less falls and really consistent performances. Do you put that down to anything in particular? Have you worked on anything?
The fact that now I know what's underneath me. I know what tyres are underneath me and, you know, the bike feels the same from the practice until the race. Whereas last year, the bike, you know, I never crashed in practice sessions. Everything felt fine, and I get in the race, and the bike would feel like a piece of crap, basically. So I think it's the fact that, you know, people are out there working hard for me instead of against me.
Did you get a bit of a rap that you didn't really deserve last year then, do you reckon?
Personally, and I think, you know, a lot of people should back off a lot of other people that crash and, you know, don't have... you know, such a nice time, but we are out there giving it our best, and people should just lay off.
Casey, how much do you put that down to the Bridgestone front tyre? Because everyone's raved about that this year, and your crashes last year were mostly front end. Is it just that front end tyre has just been so phenomenal?
I was losing the front on the exit of corners, not on the entry. And okay. Normally your support is on the entry of a corner where you'd normally lose it. So my crashes last year were pretty alien, I think, to anything. You don't normally lose the front on the exit. You know, on a car, maybe you get understeer, but not on a bike. So I don't believe... you know, the profile of the Bridgestone has anything to do with that, but I definitely get a lot more feedback with the Bridgestone tyres, and I get a lot more feedback from the staff themselves, you know, putting a lot more backing towards me.
Casey, just picking up on something that you said with all that tyre discussion yesterday, is there still a feeling, do you have a feeling that there's still people within Formula 1 who haven't, I mean probably within the MotoGP, who haven't given you due credit for what you've actually achieved as a rider this year, or is it more that people are just still getting their heads around the fact that you're the best out there this season?
I'm not looking for credit, but I'm looking for fairness, and I think the tyre rule that they brought in this year, not to be able to fly tyres in overnight, is nothing but fair, and you know, they just should leave things the way they are. And you know, like I said, I'm not looking for credit from anyone. You know, we did this job for us. And, you know, I'm very proud of the team. I'm proud of Ducati for what they've done for me. And, yeah, that's what I'm looking for.
So the attitude, I mean, does it stick in your craw in terms of the attitude of other riders if they haven't given you, say, the praise just for your riding skills as opposed to technical advantages?
Yeah, well, you know, beginning of the season, everybody was saying how quick the Ducati was, the only reason I was winning, and then we went to tracks that you basically don't even get into top gear, and, you know, we're still winning probably by a lot bigger margin than what we did in the bigger tracks. So, I mean, people can whinge and bitch and whine about as much as they want, but, you know, we've all got to ride what bikes we're on, and, you know, there's always been previous years where one bike's been a bit better than the other, but, you know, people bring it back and they come back the next year, so we just have to concentrate on that.
I was going to ask you that, whether the bitching and moaning is just that's a part of the sport every year, or whether there's something about you that they're having trouble accepting as the guy who's doing it best this year.
I think they are having a lot of trouble accepting it, and you know, we've, like I said, I've worked hard for this, and you know, I gave Danny a run for his money and 250 championship, and you know, things didn't go right then, but if they'd gone a little bit better in a few other races, then I think we could have really pushed him to the end. And but you know, if Danny won the championship, nobody would look, you know, blink twice. You know, they expected him to be able to push Valentino for the championship. So if I can push Danny for a championship and, you know, he can push Valentino, what's the difference between me pushing Valentino? And there's no reason why I can't win this championship. And I think all of us together, the effort we've done with the whole team, is just, you know, there's no reason anybody should take any credit away from anything.
Casey, last year at your press conference, I think about 3 people, you slipped into Melbourne almost unnoticed. And the other day I noticed your wife being asked for autographs. How has your life, for both of you, changed in this last 12 months?
Quite a bit. I mean, you know, we haven't been in Australia much, so we haven't noticed the differences a heck of a lot until this last weekend, really. But, I mean, a lot more people are taking notice of us now, but, I mean, that's not why we're here.
How did you feel at Fed Square the other day? Was it nice having the Australians all there just out to see you?
Yeah, it was pretty good. I mean, I had a couple of weeks to cool down after the last GP, and you know, it was nice to finally come back and you know, see some Aussies around, and there's a lot of kids out there as well, which was pretty important.
How good was that cool down period?
probably one of the best in my life, I think. You know, I've had no stress. I haven't had to do any media work, which has been absolute dream. I haven't had any appointments, so I've been able to do whatever I want during the day, and it's been very, very relaxing for a couple of weeks.
Were you exercising, training in that sense?
Always.
Yeah.
What else did you do to relax?
For me, I don't know. Bit of fishing and things like that, but...
Back on the dirt bike?
A little bit, not much. Just cruising around the farm a little bit and just spending time with my family, really.
Just on the dirt bike, obviously you won plenty of Australian championships before you left for overseas. How important was sort of that section of that phase of your career?
I think dirt track was one of the best things we could have ever done, you know, to start our career. I would have liked to have done maybe a little bit of mini moto just to learn how to carry corner speed for when I raced the 125 and 250s, but I mean, you know, I ended up learning enough, I suppose, for the class that we wanted to grow into.
And your thoughts on junior competition and, I guess, dirt track racing in Australia?
For me, it needs to still expand. I mean, it's really dropped off since we pretty much left dirt track. You know, myself, Chris, Anthony, Brock Parks, you know, we all came through at the same time. They're in old age groups, of course, but... I mean, you know, it really needs to be brought up again. You know, a lot of tracks are being closed down because of... all these new properties going up, things like that, and you know, really something needs to be done and somewhere for the kids to ride, I suppose.
Okay, so you seem to get the bike set up very quickly. Can you tell us about your relationship with your engineer and the team generally?
Basically, I mean, this is the first team that's really sort of understood me, I suppose, and you know, we know what we want, we know what we want the bike to do, and we go to each track and just make an assumption of what we need. And we never get the bike set up that well. We're always, you know, quite a little bit off what times we need to be, but we just get there quicker than other people. And, you know, I suppose their first attempt at setups are a lot, you know, sort of closer than what most other teams are.
Have you got much to come and set up for this weekend?
No, like I said, we did pretty much setting we did for testing, which we were quite happy with. Quite a lot different to what we've been doing in previous races. But, again, we changed a little bit back to similar what we had previous races and... we got a little bit faster there towards the end.
Casey, how much time would you get off at the end of the season before you start testing again? You planning a break?
Not really, because this is probably going to be the only break I had. Because now, you know, as soon as the season stops, I've got to start training again, getting myself ready for the next year. And if we're not testing, I'm training. And, you know, if there's a lot of travelling over to Europe and back, things like that. So it takes up quite a lot of time.
Is it tiring you? Coping with it all right?
I'm sure it will in the end, and that's why I'm going to sort of set a limit to, you know, when basically I've got to finish with this sport and start maybe, you know, doing other aspects of it, maybe helping out with younger riders and teams. But as for riding and, you know, travelling week in, week out, I think, you know, there's going to be a cut off time eventually.
So you feel you need the time to recover even now, do you?
Yeah, for sure, but I mean, in previous years I was a lot more stressed than this year, no matter what, even at the beginning of the season. Ducati handle things very well and give me time off when I need it, and you know, it gives me time to recover and get ready for the next one.
Just on the junior teams in Australia, you're sponsoring a rider this year in the Australian 125s. Last year you spoke about how important it was to go through that path rather than riding a superbike. Tell us, why are you supporting this young rider in the 125 category?
Basically, we've been wanting to set up a team for quite a while in the Australian series, just to you know, basically we need to find kids with the right stuff, the right attitude and the right talent. You know, we've got quite a few contacts now that people never really helped us any three Grand Prix. You know, we had a lot of Europeans help us three Grand Prix, Alberto Puig and Lucio Ticinello, but nobody else helped us that did actually have power. And now we've got the right contacts, we've got quite a few friends in the paddock that I know that are going to help us out, you know, when we do find you know, some riders. But you know, again, it's difficult for an Australian rider to come over into Grand Prix, and if they really want it badly enough, then we'll give them a chance.
Casey, I'm sorry, but just to pick up on what you said there and what you didn't say, you didn't mention commitment from that young rider, and that seems to me to be a major thing that's got you to where you are.
I basically said that in another way, I suppose, but yeah, I mean, they've got to have it, they've got to, you know, they've just got to want it bad enough, and I suppose if you want it bad enough, then you're going to commit to it. And I suppose, you know, that's what myself and my family did, and we know what it takes, we know how hard it is, but we also know, like I said, a lot of people in the paddock that are going to help us out.
because really, in the end, for Australian riders, talent must speak because money can't. You didn't go to Europe with the backing of a major sponsor as a lot of the European riders. And we've seen a lot of European riders who probably shouldn't have a seat get one because of the money they bring to it. So it's really important to, obviously, for you to help nurture these talent into Europe.
Basically, but like I said, you know, if they haven't got it, we're going to have to be, you know, quite harsh, because you're not going to go over there. You've got to impress immediately. If you don't impress, then, you know, you're basically just watching your pockets empty, because...
And the Spanish domestic series is still the best way, you think, to the MotoGP seat?
Yeah, I believe the Spanish series was a very good way for me. I don't know what it's like these days. I haven't been there for a while now, but I still like to understand. But Alberto believes it's still the way to go, and, you know, we have a lot of faith in Alberto's word as well.
Valentino's been the biggest name in the sport for a few years now. How would you describe the rivalry that's developed between you and him? What do you think of him as a rider?
I mean, you know, he's been one of my idols for a long time. You know, myself and a few of my friends in Grand Prix, we used to go out and watch basically every session of his, and just be in awe of his talent and, you know, the way he just used to dominate. So, you know, along with Mick Doohan, you know, I was always, you know, every time he was on TV, I was watching. And, you know, they're the sort of people that I wanted to become like. And
he's got a bit of a history of having some pretty bitter rivalries with people like Max Biaggi. Is it important to you that your rivalry with him isn't like that, that it's an on-the-track rivalry?
I actually spoke to him this year and basically told him, you know, that I don't want it to end up like he did with Sete or Max Biaggi. And unfortunately, you know, he hasn't really spoken to me in a while now, and seems to be throwing in a few comments that, you know, not really so happy with. But I mean, I've got no issues with him, and I've got no issues with most riders in the paddock, so I don't think there's going to be a drama.
We'll have to finish it up now.
Well, it was super interesting stuff hearing a raw press conference like that. Now let's listen to the interview with Ant West that Thomas did.
And we were just speaking to Casey Stoner, and if he's had a crazy year, you can almost match him. Tell us a bit about, I mean, really, you're sitting in the Kawasaki tent here, you're a Kawasaki factory rider. Did you ever think you'd get to this in such a short space of time?
No, definitely not. The way that the year started out, I'd never expected to be on the factory Kawasaki, and it's a dream come true, and it's what I've been working for the last 8 years or so. So it's a big change around, and just so glad to be here. It's a lot of hard work I put into it, and it's great to be here, and I'm having a lot of fun.
There's a lot of hard work, but there's a bit of luck and timing as well involved, wasn't there, this year?
Yeah, this year, actually, luck and a bit of timing worked my way. The other years, everything sort of turned to, yeah, not real good.
I remember last year at the press conference here, you were at the end, and Nick Harris actually said, "What have you got to do to get yourself a ride?" And you're a bit bemused. It's unbelievable how quickly things can change.
Yeah, a lot of people started saying the same thing. Like, well, what do you have to do? Like, I'd already done a lot of good things on 250. Like, I only go on the kid bike getting podiums and stuff. And so I don't know what else I had to do. And that's why I was just going to leave and go to ride 600. And I had some good results there. And it's funny though. I was sort of saying goodbye to everyone in the paddock, saying I'm never going to be in GP again. And next minute, I've got Kawasaki ringing me up, saying, "Oh, you want to test the bike?" So you either have nothing or everything comes at once. So.
And 2008 even must be even more exciting for you, knowing that you actually have 12 months.
Yeah, definitely. It's the first time I've actually signed a contract before Christmas. So
how important is the pre-season going to be? How important is that pre-season with the team going to be for you?
Oh, it's really important because in testing we'll probably do more laps, more kilometres on the bike than what we will in the whole race season. And all these guys have been testing all season. I've had many years on the bike, so it's going to be good for me to catch up and actually try a few different things and get the bike set up for me.
Last time you were in the top category, it was on a two-stroke. What's it been like coming to a four-stroke? Has that been a bit of a... Did riding the Supersport help, or has it just been totally different?
When I started, like 16 years old, I was racing the VTR 1000, like superbike thing. So I always liked bigger bikes, and I hated riding 250, but I was just sort of stuck there. And riding the 600 helped a little bit, but and I thought riding these things would be easy, but they're just wild and there's so much power, so you can't really compare them to anything, but riding bigger bikes and from before definitely helped.
The era, it seems, of 800s is the era of the 250 rider rather than the superbike rider. In Australia, the focus is very much on superbike riding. Where are our next MotoGP riders really going to come from?
I still think coming from 250, because like even though the superbike is more similar to the Grand Prix bike, the problem they have is they don't get to set up the bike. Like you just have a street bike and you can't really change much on them, so you don't really get to learn anything. You sort of got to ride what you have and just deal with it. But with these things, you've got so many settings and you can make a big improvement if you get the setup right. So you still have to learn how to set up the bike, and you can only do that in 250 because you have those options of
doing it. Now, regarding this weekend, you're praying for rain or are you happy to go with a dry track?
Oh, normally I don't mind when it's raining, but it's so cold here, I hate the rain here.
The vented leathers are still in the trailer?
Yeah, definitely. It's just, I don't know, Phillip Island here in the rain is not nice, but just because of the wind and just the cold. You can't even feel what the brake lever or what you're doing with throttle, because all your hands go numb.
But in the paddock, you're renowned as someone who likes it wet, but do you think that'll give you an advantage if it rains on Sunday, or are you just saying bring on whatever conditions?
Yeah, just bring on whatever happens, and everyone has to ride in the same conditions, so it's the same for everyone, and for me it doesn't really bother me, just as long as it's not too cold, because I've come from Queensland, I don't like the cold.
How do you ride the circuit here, and do you notice the fact that it's an Australian, completely Australian crowd? Do you actually notice that?
Yeah, the crowd would be different to anywhere else you go around the world, and I don't know, they're pretty cool, pretty funny people, and it's just good to be here in front of my family and friends and Australian people, because we're away for so long, so you sort of really miss the Australian style and everything like that.
Has there been more of an adjustment with getting to the factory ride, signing more autographs, more photo shoots,
more press conferences?
Yeah,
how have you managed that?
I don't mind it. I like it. It's good. Yeah, there is a lot more press and a lot more people interested, but and also a lot more people sort of, like, it's funny, like, people that have sort of ignored me in the paddock before of like, my best mate all of a sudden, so there's a few sharks that you have to be careful of, but...
Do you have a long-term memory?
Yeah, definitely. I haven't forgot who'd sort of dogged me in the last few years, and I'm definitely going to let them know when I get to the top.
Does that include yourself, Ant? Because you've been famous occasionally for letting slip at times when perhaps it might have been better to walk into the trailer.
Yeah, definitely. I've let it slip out a few times, but I don't know. You get so frustrated with all the things that go on and all the politics, which a lot of people probably don't see, and like people say, oh, you shouldn't have said that, but they're not there and in the paddock and putting up with all the things that go on, but I'm just happy now to be where I am, and yeah, I'm a lot more happier just with everything.
So. And just turning to Casey Stoner, is Casey's presence in the paddock going to make it easier for you perhaps next year to slide under the radar and do your own thing?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really bother what other guys are doing on the track.
If you were the only Australian rider in MotoGP, there'd be more than, you know, the weight of expectation would be very heavy. Do you think it's actually easier having Casey taking a lot of the focus and you can just stick to doing what you do best?
Nah, not really. Because what you want to do is beat the next Aussie, so it's sort of more pressure because you want to beat the other Aussies. And but... Yeah, I try not to worry about that anyway and just do my own thing, and I want to win races as well, whether it's Casey or anyone else in the track.
What's it like having Chris and Casey in the paddock with you? Does it make life a little easier, or is it they just two other guys to race against?
Yeah, just two other guys to race against, definitely. And they're both good guys. It's good to have Australians around, but I don't know. I think it sort of upsets a lot of the other sponsors and teams because they don't like it when the Australians are winning all the time. We've had so many world championships champions that were Australian, so all the Europeans, I think, are getting a bit stressed about that.
And just to finish off, I noticed your left hand's taped up. Anything carrying an injury there?
Yeah, old injury here. Crash, turn one.
Turn one crash, yeah.
Yeah, 267 or something it was. so it doesn't bother me riding. I just have to tape it up because I've still got plate and screws and that in it. But it's no worries.
Alrighty, thanks.
Thank you.
Big thank you to Thomas for providing us those interviews and the press conference. That's really great. I'm glad he managed to work out the rights so that we could be released and we're actually broadcasting them legally and all of that. And it's kind of cool to hear the whole unedited raw thing. This is one of the special things about podcasting where we can do that. We don't have to edit it down to a certain length or something like that. So again, thank you very much, Thomas. That was really interesting stuff. And that's going to do it for today's show. Hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much for downloading it. Don't forget the time change Sunday morning and make sure that you go online to double check the times for the Valencia Grand Prix there. If you're going to watch it live, it should be at 5 a.m. Pacific, 8 a.m. Eastern in the United States. That'll be the time. And it's at 1400 Central European time, whatever it is in Spain. So that'll be the live time to check out the race, MotoGP at MotoGP.com. If you're watching it on Speed TV, they're going to broadcast it at, oh boy, on their schedule it says 2 p.m. for the 250s and 3 p.m. for MotoGP. You know, I'm not 100% sure if that's taking the time change into effect or not, because that is a little earlier than normal. So double check that too. It may well be. Those are the times Pacific, 2 p.m. and 3 p.m. on their website right now. However, with the time change, it might be an hour earlier. So make sure you double check your TV listings and all that and take that ridiculous daylight savings times into account. So that's going to do it. Again, thanks very much for downloading the show. And we will talk to you later after we've wrapped up the MotoGP season. And we're going to talk about that a lot. MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I'm solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.